Just want to start by doing a sound check. Can you all hear me okay? Good, excellent. This evening's talk is on a subject that, in many respects, is quite difficult. It's a question that mankind has asked for probably for as long as mankind has asked any kind of questions forever. What happens when we die? It's difficult because we can prove very little about what we believe. So the information I'm going to share with you is my belief and not necessarily proven facts. There are very few facts on this subject. But my beliefs have been gained over a period of some 45 years of investigating this subject. And much of my information has come from people who claim to be dead. So they're people who, if this is correct, know far more about life after death and what happens when we die than we do, because they've tried it. They've been through the experience, they're there. I do have some personal first-hand experience because I've had a near-death experience myself. I've also visited what we call the spirit world. I've been there. So I have some personal experience. But the one thing that has interested me about studying the spiritualist hypothesis on this subject is that most of the information is very consistent. It's not often we come across something within spiritualism. The teachings from the very beginnings, the 1848 through the latter half of the 19th century to the current day, it's not often we find things that are seemingly contradictory. So that in itself is reassuring. But I simply have to say to you this: all that I'm going to bring to you is either someone else's opinion or my opinion. Little of it is scientifically provable. I want to start off with, firstly, the actual technical aspects of the dying process, because our question is not what happens when we're dead, but what happens when we die. So we'll take it in chronological order. We believe that right here and now in our world, in the physical world, we're composed of multiple bodies. We're not just a physical body. We believe that the mind isn't even physical in itself. As a spiritualist, we separate the mind from the brain simply being a physical organ, that will die along with the physical body. We are not physical beings waiting to die to become spirit. We are spirit here and now. We have a spirit body right now. It's sometimes called the etheric counterpart. There are many different names for it. But because we have a spirit body right here and now, we have a physical body, of course, there are connections between the two. And there are conduits between the two that transfer vital energies from the spirit side of things through to the physical that effectively keep us going, keep us alive. Sometimes these are called chakras, energy centers. They have many different names. One thing that does make me smile sometimes is when people talk about closing down their energy centers. If you could do that, which you can't, fortunately, you'd actually drop dead. Your physical body relies upon these conduits to provide it with vital energies. Right now, whilst we are in the physical and we're hopefully not ill, not on our deathbeds right now, our mind, our consciousness is firmly seated within the physical. We draw our information through the five physical senses: sight, hearing, touch, smell, taste. Our mind is gathering information through all of those. Our spirit body also has corresponding senses. And our spirit vision, we call clairvoyance, hearing, clairaudience, etc. But because our mind is currently firmly seated in the physical, we draw virtually all of our input to the mind through the physical senses. Some people, however, have the ability to retune the mind and start to draw some information through their spiritual senses. Those people, called mediums. And that's exactly what they do. They retune the mind to draw some information through their spiritual senses. We don't gain these abilities upon death. You've got them right now. If we didn't have them, and if we didn't have a spirit body right now, we couldn't access any information about the spiritual world at all. Yet, I'm sure many of you are mediums, you clearly would say, yes, we can. So, our mind is firmly seated in the physical. Now, as we are starting to die, if we're talking about a natural death, those bonds between the etheric body, the spirit counterpart, and the physical start to slacken. The mind also, which is normally firmly seated in the physical, starts to shift. You might say starts to shift its allegiance a bit. And it's almost like some scales tipping. As the physical senses weaken, the spiritual senses strengthen. And this is why it's fairly common for people in the last few days of their life, when particularly, as I say, when they're dying from a natural death as opposed to being hit by a bus or shot or blown up, but a natural death, which takes time, they very often report seeing people whom they've once known, particularly their parents, their grandparents, their loved ones who have gone on before them. You'll often hear them talking to people that you yourself, unless you're clairvoyant, of course, can't see. It's really quite common. And that's simply because the bonds between the mind and the physical are slackening. At the same time, the bonds between the mind and the spiritual senses are strengthening. They're starting to experience that shift where they're drawing the input through to the mind. The point comes eventually, the moment of death, where the mind and the spirit and the connections between them and the physical are finally severed. It's sometimes referred to as the silver cord. Can't say I've ever witnessed that, and I've only actually physically stood there on one occasion at the point someone actually made their transition. And besides being disappointed at losing the person, because it was my father-in-law, the other thing that disappointed me was, although I was trying to tune in to get a wider experience of this event, neither my clairsentience or clairvoyance, none of these senses, detected anything, which was sadly a little disappointing. I was hoping to add to my knowledge of this event. Didn't happen, of course. So, the actual process of dying, when it's done by natural causes, usually can be quite peaceful. It's a transition that can take several days. In every case that I've spoken to people about where the mindset of those that are dying is very open, or they have a knowledge of what happens when they die, we get very consistent reports that there was someone there whom they recognized, who met them, who welcomed them, who explained to them basically what had happened and helped them from that moment onwards. One thing that is very consistent and very clear from spirit teachings is there is no time lapse. There's no sleeping in the grave for X number of days. There's no so many hours as a consistent law or rule before someone is allowed to communicate. I've come across many cases of people communicating within minutes of their death. So it's a complete fallacy. Where there can be problems arising is the individual's expectations of what happens when you die. Let's take an atheist, for example, who believes there is nothing. They believe death is the end. There's nothing after it. That's it. The lights go out, we draw our last breath, and it's all over. Imagine the confusion that's going to be upon finding yourself not dead, or waking up in the morning, not knowing you've died in your sleep, and people don't talk to you anymore. People seem to ignore you. That could be very confusing, and I'm sure it is for many of them. But regardless of the method of passing, whether it be through something very quickly or even instantaneous, where clearly there's going to be a certain amount of shock, whether it's somebody who knows exactly what's happening to them and they're expecting it and they're ready for it. One thing that is very clear from the spirit world, no passing from our world to the next is a surprise to those in the spirit world. No passing goes unmarked and unprepared for. Judy Seaman, I believe, currently is the best trance medium I know of that's still alive today. I've witnessed trance mediumship through people such as Gordon Higginson, etc. But Judith is, in my opinion, the best one today. So when I have the opportunity to talk to people like Jackson, one of Judith's controls, I place high credibility on what's said to me. And I'm going to quote from Jackson now in answering a question. And the question was about so-called lost souls and about people who believe they are rescuing them. Jackson's answer was very clear, and that's why I like it, and that's why I'm quoting from it. Jackson said this, quite simply, there are no lost souls. No one gets lost. No one goes, no one disappears, no one is misplaced. There are no lost souls. He went on to say about so-called rescue circles, people who think they're rescuing so-called lost souls, but if there aren't any, what are they rescuing? He said, who do you people think you are, that you're better equipped than we are at dealing with people who come to our world? Makes a lot of sense to me. Now, there's going to be people who make the transition with confused minds, whose expectations perhaps are very different from reality. And there are people whose jobs it is in the spirit world to meet these people and help them make this transition. Only a couple of weeks ago in America, I was doing a trance demonstration, and apparently one of the things that was said by the control, we know as John, when asked a question, what can people do here to prepare themselves for making this transition from our world to the next? And his answer was fairly short, actually, and quite concise. He simply said, educate them. It's so much better to pass from our world, the physical world, to their world with a knowledge and an understanding of what will happen than to pass with no understanding, or even worse, to pass with false understanding. And sadly, there are many faiths who teach false understandings by our reckoning as to what happens when we die. So we've talked a little bit about what happens through a natural passing. Very often it can take several days. The bonds between the physical and the mind slacken. The bonds between the mind and the spirit body strengthen until finally the bonds with the physical are completely severed. What happens when people die through a serious illness, through instantaneously, perhaps in wartime, through being blown up, shot, etc.? And I want to recount to you a story that came through the mediumship of a vice medium. And this is the spirit person themselves talking through a voice medium. So they're not actually talking through the vocal organs of the medium. This is physical mediumship. And this man was a soldier in the British Army in the First World War. And he remembers he was walking along a trench with some of his mates, going somewhere, going about their business. And he doesn't remember exactly what happened next, but all of a sudden they found themselves still with the same group of people out in the countryside somewhere. The first thing they noticed was the lack of sound of the gunfire, the shells going off, the artillery. Warfare is incredibly noisy, but they could hear nature, birds. The trenches were gone, but yet there's five of them were still together walking along this particular pathway. And he said, over a period of time, his friends, one by one, basically slowly disappeared until he eventually found himself on his own. And he decided to sit down under a nearby tree to think about what had happened. He really was struggling to understand where he was and what was going on. And he sat under this tree and started thinking, and he wondered if perhaps he'd died. And upon having those thoughts, a relative of his whom he'd known who had been dead for a number of years appeared and walked up to him and explained to him exactly what had happened. Whilst walking along the trench, a shell had landed right in the middle. All of them had been killed instantaneously, so there was no understanding that is what had happened to them. So they were instantly ejected from the physical world. There was no shock or anything because they didn't know. And it took a period of time as each and every one of them, in their own time, adjusted, came to an understanding. But it was only when they'd come to an understanding what had happened that somebody familiar to them was able to talk to them. What I find rather interesting about this story is that the relative has said to him, the length of time it has taken you from when you were killed in the trenches until now, when I've been able to get through to you and talk to you, by normal earth standards, has been 42 years. Yet by his personal experience, it seemed like a matter of hours or days. And this reinforces something that I've also heard from the spirit world. When people say there is no time in the spirit world, it's not actually true. There is time, but it's personal. Whereas time in our world, it's universal. We all measure it the same way. The sun rises, the sun sets, it's a day. We have clocks and watches, we measure time as the planet rotates around the sun, we get 1 year. But in the spirit world, it can be more personal time. Hence, in this soldier's experience, his experience was a matter of days, yet 42 years had elapsed. The medium, through whom's vice and mediumship this story was recounted, was Leslie Flint. And if you want to know more about Leslie Flint and the voices that came through him, there is a website you can go to. Just put in a search for Leslie Flint, and there are a lot of live recordings of voice seances, and that was one of them I listened to some years ago. So time can be personal. And that is the experience of someone who died who actually didn't know they'd died. We then get the other issue of people who die who have suffered for a period of time, sometimes for several years, with perhaps either a debilitating physical condition or a mental condition. People perhaps who die with Alzheimer's. And I have a personal experience I'd like to recount to help you understand our understanding of this. One of the abilities I have through my, not just mediumship, but as a psychic ability, is called medical clairsentience. I have the ability to tune into people and quite literally, objectively feel their physical pains, emotional, mental states, etc. And on one occasion, I was working with a doctor in Germany and who knew about these abilities of mine, and he wanted me to use them on a patient who had Alzheimer's. He wanted to see if it was possible for me to identify areas of the brain where there were problems and to exactly what it was I was experiencing, because he couldn't ask the patient because she had short-term memory problems. She could tell you all about her experiences in the war 60, 70 years ago, but she couldn't tell you what she had for breakfast that day, and very often she wouldn't even recognize her own relatives. So I tuned into the patient, and one thing that became very clear to me was there was nothing wrong with the actual mind of this person. Remember, the mind is not physical. The mind survives death, intact. All its memories, everything. What was wrong was the connection in certain areas between the mind and the brain. And the word that I received, because I wasn't just working psychically now, I was also information being substituted by friends in the spirit world. The word they used was there is a dislocation between certain areas of the brain and the mind itself. And this dislocation meant the mind was having difficulty expressing itself in certain ways through the brain and therefore being able to speak and tell us memories. And I described to the doctor the area of the brain where the dislocation was, and he said that makes complete sense to him because that's the area responsible for short-term memory. So quite good evidence. Patient had short-term memory problems, as I said earlier. What's interesting about this is, and gives us all hope for people who we know who perhaps are suffering from Alzheimer's, it's entirely a physical condition. The moment the spirit is released from the physical body, they leave behind that condition. There's nothing wrong with them. So the mind of the spirit person is completely free of Alzheimer's. However, that does not mean there's an instantaneous recovery of that mind. You know what it's like, I'm sure, if you hurt your leg and you limp around for a few days, even though the pain has gone and our leg's okay, we still limp for a little while. It's almost like a habit. It takes time for us to readjust to not limping. When someone has suffered, and the longer they've suffered here through some kind of mental condition, it takes a while after their transition to the spirit world to readjust to not having the condition. So although technically their spirit body is not affected by it, remember the mind is seated in the physical whilst here, and therefore there will be residual effects upon the mind even after it's severed its links with the physical. And it will take time for an adjustment to take place for a full recovery so they can function quite normally through their spiritual body. And we're told again that there are people in the spirit world whose job it is to help those who are going through this. They go through a period of convalescence. One thing that I like about spiritualism and about these teachings is it removes fear. And one of our main objectives is to remove the fear of death. And that's what we're trying to do by bringing this information and by studying this event. And I want to share with you now my personal experience of the first time I had a near-death experience because this removing of fear played an important part in it. It must have been 16, 17, maybe 18 years ago now. Time moves on quite quickly. And it was prior to my working full-time as a spiritualist minister and a medium. I had a proper job in those days. I was a salesman, and I went to a town in East Yorkshire called Goole. I went into these offices to talk to someone, and I started to feel rather peculiar. Not sick in a sense, but just a bit weird, a bit disorientated to start with. And then it was this, my senses were starting to fade a little. So I sat down. And it continued to get worse. For some strange reason, I decided to sit on the floor, and it continued to get worse. What I didn't know was at that point, somebody telephoned for an ambulance for paramedics. But in the meantime, I'm sat on the floor wondering what on earth is happening to me. At first, and this is quite interesting to me, as a trance medium, a lot of it was very familiar. The input through my normal physical senses was fading. I couldn't see anything because my eyes were closed. However, Close your eyes and it usually goes dark. It hadn't gone dark. It was very white, quite bright. I couldn't feel my body by the time I got to sitting on the floor. My body had faded away. That in itself's not unusual because I experience that virtually every time I go into trance. Probably every time, actually. So my body had faded away. I couldn't really feel that anymore. There was no pain, which was quite good. I don't like pain. But what was a little disconcerting, which it told me this was different, my hearing was fading. Normally, when I'm in a trance state, particularly a trance control state, my hearing doesn't go. So only when I move into a deep trance state and I lose consciousness completely, I have no hearing. I have no memory of what takes place then. But my hearing went, so I can't hear anything, can't feel my body, and all I can see is bright white everywhere, fairly uniform at that point. Yet my mind was working completely normally. And I remember thinking, I wonder if people know who I am. So I think it's very clear that at that point I believed I was dying. And the reason why I had that thought was because I have a habit of leaving my wallet with my identification in it in my car rather than carry it with me. You don't spend money that way. So I remember thinking, I've got no identification on me. Will people know who I am? I remember thinking, feeling quite disappointed because I clearly now believed I was dying. Because I remember thinking that there's lots of things I still wanted to do in life, and I'm now not going to get the opportunity to do them. I then remember thinking, oh well, at least it doesn't hurt. That's the good bit about it. There's no pain. And remember the white light I told you about? Everywhere was fairly uniform white. That started to change. Ahead of me, it started to get brighter white. And it started to become quite intense. And I then found myself almost as if I was floating or gravitating towards that intense light. I can't say I got up and walked. It was as if I just started to gravitate towards it. At that point, what's very clear to me is my last thought before what happened next was, oh well, at least it doesn't hurt. Here we go. But what's also clear is I had no fear whatsoever. It was clear to me I was dying, and I didn't fear it. My mind, right throughout, worked completely normally and was very rational. So if my investigation of spiritualism, death and dying, has done one thing for me, it's removed the fear of the event. So my last thought then was, oh well, here we go. And that's when paramedics arrived and stuck me on oxygen, which brought me back. And I have to say, a small part of me somewhere wanted to carry on going. They put me on oxygen and took me to a hospital, stuck me in an ambulance, took me to a hospital, stuck me on a bed. And then I was absolutely convinced I'd died. Because this hospital was unlike any other hospital I'd ever been to in my life. There was no people. Hospitals are really busy places. Go into a ward, there's people in the beds, there's doctors, nurses milling around, there might be visitors, there might be cleaners, there's posters stuck up all over the wall, there's equipment lying around. This place was brand spanking new looking, gleaming. Not a single patient on a single bed, no one walking around, nothing. Spotlessly clean. So I'm sat on this bed thinking, I've died and no one's telling me. After a little while, a nurse came in and she said she wanted to take a blood sample. And I remember thinking at her, it's okay, you can tell me, I'm a spiritualist, I understand. And she ignored me, took the blood and went away. I thought, oh, telepathy's not working very well yet. Perhaps it doesn't work for the first hour or so after you're dead. Might kick in tomorrow. And then I remember thinking, any minute now, my grandmother's going to walk round the corner and say, I've got some good news and some bad news for you. But she didn't. And after another while, a doctor came and says, you're okay, you can go now. And I says, oh, but I don't know where to go. There's no one here to meet me. He said, well, just go back to where you come from. You're all right. I said, what do you mean back where I come from? I said, aren't I dead? And he says, no. He laughed and says, no, of course not. I said, but what's wrong with this hospital? Why aren't there any people here? He says, oh, we haven't opened yet. It's a brand new hospital, and it's not due to open till next week. But because we're the closest to where you were and the state you were in, they brought you here first. He said, the only reason why I'm here is I'm calibrating some medical equipment. And what was good was he had a blood sample to calibrate his equipment with, mine. How strange is that story? But the important thing in it is no fear. A slight after story, I went through to the reception, and this hospital's out in the countryside, and there was a man waiting with a van, and he was the one that called the ambulance. And he said, I can give you a lift back to the town if you like. I said, oh, please. Oh, excuse me. Sat in his, excuse me a moment. Need a drink. Sat in his van going back to the town. This man, he was only a young man, perhaps mid-20s, said to me, he said, can I ask you a question? I said, yes, of course. He said, have you ever heard of the Arthur Findlay College? I said, heard of it? I work there. And he said, oh. He said, well, I was there last week on a course, my very first one. And when you were lying on the floor and we were waiting for the ambulance, I saw the most amazing colours around you. Over the next year or two, I got to meet this man on quite a number of occasions. And that man now, the last time I saw him, conducts our church services in various churches, a working medium now. He managed to turn his life round from being a drug addict, having lost his family through it, and through working with the spirit world, and we managed to help him turn everything round. And I often wonder, was the experience just to get to meet that man? Because if it was, there's got to be easier ways. So it's very important we remove fear. So the dying process, we've talked about that from the perspective of someone dying instantaneously, people dying through natural causes where it's slow, people dying with conditions like Alzheimer's, about how there is a period of recuperation. Another aspect of now we're looking at after we've died, one thing that is very clear and consistent, no one's lost, everyone's expected, and everyone is met by someone. John, who is the name that's used by the controlling group for me for trance and speaking, very occasionally talks about, I won't say occasionally, actually talks about it quite a lot, about one of the experiences he had after he died. There's a saying, isn't there, that your whole life flashes before you as you die. He actually said that's not quite true. But he said what happened is that after he'd been there for a while and was trying to come to terms with a very big change in his life, because when he was here, he lived a very privileged life. And it took a while for him to adjust to his new conditions. There was two people paid him a visit. He calls them the twins. I'm presuming that's because they were probably twins. They came to pay him a visit. And they said they've come to talk to him about his life back on Earth. And he was quite pleased about this because he thought he'd had a marvelous life, which he now knows was not quite so. And he said what they would do when they came to visit him from time to time, they would bring up a particular aspect of his life and said, we want to go through that with you today. Not only would they sit and talk about perhaps some of the experiences he's had, opportunities that he missed where he could have helped many people, but in particular, things that he'd done that had affected other people's lives in ways that he never knew. Ways where he'd harmed or hurt people, I don't necessarily mean physically, but decisions he'd made that had quite profound effects on other people who were far less well off and less fortunate than he was. They said, what is the difficult part about this process is you don't just talk about it. These two brothers, these two twins, have the ability to help you not only understand the impact of your life's actions on others, but to experience it in some measure, how you affect others, how you we can upset or harm people, the emotional impact on others. So he went through period, quite a long period, where from time to time they would not only review an aspect of his life, but help him go through the experience of how his choices in life, his decisions, adversely affected many other people. And he found that, and he will talk about it occasionally, he found that a very trying time. It was very difficult. But clearly, principles. When we look at the fifth and sixth principles of spiritualism, personal responsibility and compensation and retribution hereafter for all the good and evil deeds done upon earth, this is how it works out, or it did with him anyway. And we then take in the seventh principle, eternal progress open to every human soul. They actually then said to him, once they'd gone through this lengthy process, there was a way where he could then now do good things. And he was ready then to accept to do some very different work from what he did here on earth. And he was trained to work with a trance medium, to work with a group of minds in the spirit world, and act as the what's sometimes called the mouthpiece, or I refer to as the front personality for a group of spirit minds to represent them through what's known as a trance speaking medium here on earth. And for whatever reasons, the people that control this and organize this chose myself as the medium for him and that group. So the work he's doing now in bringing through a greater understanding of a knowledge of what happens when we die, and in particular, how can we prepare for when we die, is his life's work now. His message is very simple and very consistent when he talks about how can we prepare for when we die. And he says quite simply, and he repeats it over and over again in different demonstrations. Go about your life committing random acts of kindness. If you do that, you should have no fear for when you come to my world. And Robert, who is the healing control, works with me, he said it a different way. In 2008, when the banks crashed, I was doing a trance healing sitting somewhere. And occasionally, in the middle of them, they will either talk to me or give me a bit of information. And on one of these occasions, Robert said to me, would you like an investment opportunity? And I thought, oh yeah, it's not very often they give you something really useful. I says, okay, yeah. He says, I have an investment proposition for you that will give you a 100% return on your investment. And I thought, I like the sound of this. I said, go on then. I'll buy into this. He said, very simple. For every act of kindness you commit whilst on earth, I will guarantee you a 100% return in the bank of spirit. And when you finally leave your world and come to mine, you can make a withdrawal. I knew there was a catch somewhere. But it's exactly what John says. How can we prepare for when we leave this life? Knowledge and understanding of what happens when we die, but most importantly, commit 100% random acts of kindness. When asked about should we love everyone, John Mann, and be kind to those you can't love. We've got about 20 minutes left now, and I want to open it up to questions. So, has anybody got any particular questions you'd like me to try to answer now? If you put something in the chat bit as to what got to the question, then you can come in. I'll pick whoever's there, and you can come in if you want to do it verbally, or if you wish to type one. But if you just want to type a question mark into the chat line, okay, Lorna, if you've got a microphone, please come in and let us hear your question.
Thank you, Stephen, for a wonderful presentation. I was wondering, besides the medical condition of Alzheimer's, are there other conditions that people may have on Earth where there is a necessity for a period of convalescence, and also that there might be remnants of that particular disease process that stays with them while they're in the heaven realm? For example, mental illness, I was thinking of.
Yes, certainly, Lord. Virtually every condition that is a long, drawn-out one, the mind itself, remember, all of these conditions, whether they be mental or physical, remain in the physical world. It's a residual mental effect upon the person. Like when I said about when we hurt our leg, we limp for a while, even though after it stops hurting, it takes us a while to get used to not limping. So any kind of condition where there's a long drawn out illness, there's going to be some residual effect. There's going to be a period of adjustment for that mind when it leaves our world and goes to the next. We don't instantly get better, as it were. Although the spirit body has none of these conditions, the mind itself still has the memory of them, because all our memories remain intact when we die. Another thing I've come across is children with autistic children, that's the word, and also children with sometimes very serious mental aging conditions. I saw a child in Germany some years ago who, through healing, whose physical age was about 7 years, her mental age was 7 months. One thing that was very clear to me was the mind and the spirit with that child was there was nothing wrong with them at all, absolutely perfect. It's purely the connections between the mind and the physical brain, these conduits, the links that allow the mind to operate in a physical world through the physical brain, through that body. So any type of condition where there's a long drawn out illness, there can be, whether it be a physical or mental, a period of convalescence. A lot of the things are scrolled up on my screen now, and I've lost who was next. Let me just find where Lorna's right. Angelique. I could listen to her. Okay. Francesca, you're the next question.
Thank you for taking my question, Stephen. While the loved one is convalescing, would that pose any difficulty for the medium to understand what the loved one is wanting to say to the recipient? In other words, does that affect us in any way? Thank you.
You may find actually that it might not necessarily be the person that you think is communicating. You might have somebody communicating directly upon their behalf, in a sense, answering for them or providing some evidence upon their behalf of their survival. Certainly, I would have thought, depending upon the level of convalescence needed, which again is directly affected by how long they were ill, the severity of their illness. But during that convalescence, I think there would be difficulties with for them doing direct communication themselves through a medium. So you're more likely to find another close relative or somebody talking upon their behalf. And I've come across this a number of times over the years with mediums, who, for example, the recipients, mother is talking about the recipient, say, brother or sister, who's in the spirit world, and the mother, who has been in the spirit world far longer, is providing evidence on their behalf because they were not yet able to communicate themselves. You understand that?
I do. Thank you. Yes, it's very clear.
I think with a lot of this, there aren't hard and fast rules. Each case has to be looked at in its own merits individually as to what people are capable of and what they're not. But if there's a need for evidence of survival to come through, then someone's going to help them. They won't just say, oh, well, never mind, wait till you're better. Someone's going to help them. So, Pia, so when... So someone with Alzheimer's dies, would this then take time for them to come through? Well, yes, that's exactly what we've just said to Francesca. I would expect so. However, just reinforcing that, you may find someone in the spirit world who's working on their behalf. Melanie, does it make a difference if done bad things on purpose or by accident? Yes, I believe it does. I actually believe that to some extent, and maybe a large extent, it isn't the actions that we do, it's what motivates us to take certain actions. And let me give you an example. Let's take two doctors, patient each. One doctor's patient, both these patients are suffering. The doctors believe both have terminal illnesses. And one doctor, through a sense of compassion, who believes there's absolutely no cure for this person and that the suffering is going to become almost unbearable for them, increases the dosage of medication to ease their passion. Effectively, we know this happens, and effectively the doctor shortens the period of suffering, and effectively, you could say, if we're blunt, ends that life, kills them. The other doctor has a patient exactly the same, yet we know this has happened in the case of, there was a very famous case in England where a doctor was getting patients to change their will in his favour, and he was then overdosing them. Technically, in both of these cases, the doctors killed someone, one of their patients. In one case, it was motivated by compassion because they genuinely believed their life expectancy was short and the quality of that remaining life was incredibly poor. The other was done for material gain. So I've chosen two cases there which are extremely opposed, diametrically opposed. The act is the same in both. Would we expect both to be treated exactly the same by a kind and a loving God? It's the motivation that is the overriding factor behind what we do, not necessarily the actual act of what we do. We can do something that upsets and hurts someone, even though we genuinely believe we were being kind and trying to help them. On the other hand, if we deliberately hurt someone, it's got to be different. Ulla, do we create our own world in spirit? To a large extent, because we're told that the spirit world is a creation of the mind. And we've had many teachings come back to us. One book that's quite interesting is actually in the SNUI bookshop, Letters from Julia. It was written through the automatic writing mediumship of William Stead. And Julia controlled his hand to write about her experiences after she died. What I find fascinating is Julia was very clearly a very devout Christian whilst on earth. So the conditions she, in a sense, contributed to or created were very Christian-oriented. But it's still a fascinating read about things she found. What I'd really like to find is a book written in the same way, but from someone who had a very, say, strong Muslim background when on earth. What did they find after they died? Someone who had, say, a very strong Buddhist view. We've got lots of writing from people who were spiritualists and quite a lot from people who had strong Christian beliefs. There's another book which isn't in the SNUI shop, but I believe is in the shop at the Arthur Findlay College, Life in the World Unseen, and a second volume, More About Life in the World Unseen, by Anthony Borgia. And they are very interesting as well, again, quite consistent with these teachings. So to some extent, we do create our own surroundings. But what creates our surroundings far more than when we get there is how we live our life here. Because universal law comes in, the law of like attracts like. Now, let me give you a choice. I can tell you now where you're going to go to in the spirit world. And I can give you a choice. Do you want to go to a place full of kind, loving people who just like helping each other because they just like helping each other, through no thought of what they're going to get out of it? They just like it. Or would you like to go to a place in the spirit world of selfish, mean people who all they think about is their own gratification? I'm sure it's a no-brainer. I'm sure you're all going to choose to go to a place full of kind and loving people. Well, here's the interesting thing. I can tell you how to go there. It's so simple. You've got to be one. How you live this life determines initially where you'll find yourself. Because the type of person you become, by that moment we leave this world, naturally our soul will gravitate to a place of similar souls. So yes, we do create a lot of what we'll find in the spirit world, particularly initially, by how we've lived this life. Irene, about lost souls, please explain about the 44 years. Would you not say he was a lost soul and people should leave them alone? A number of questions there. Firstly, I want to take the last one first, leave them alone. Well, you aren't actually doing anything with them anyway. The spirit world, you could reverse it and say, should the spirit world leave us alone? You cannot call up the spirit world. No medium should profess to be able to contact a specific person in the spirit world, although very often they can do. There's no guarantees that you can. So it isn't a sense of leaving them alone. There's nothing much you can do anyway. If they don't want to talk to us, they can't. I could telephone you up, but if you don't want to answer the telephone, I can't talk to you. So don't worry about the second part. There's not a lot we can do. I suppose you could say, in a sense, they're lost, but not lost in the sense that many people refer to. What people are referring to with lost souls is they've left this world but not arrived in the spirit world. And they think that they're wandering around somewhere lost and suffering. This man was clearly not suffering. He was wandering around. He was walking along with his mates, which was what exactly he was doing when he died. And over a period of time, as his mates just went away somewhere else, he found himself on his own. He sat down to try and figure out what had happened. When he'd come to an understanding, he died, then he could move on with his relatives. Now, because his experience of the event seemed like only a few days, then clearly he wasn't suffering, because we think, oh gosh, 44 years wandering around. But for him, the experience, his personal time, was far shorter. Hope that's helped, Irene. Karen, can you talk for a few minutes on the idea of hauntings by spirit people in spirit? Not the linger energy imprint of ghosts. It's a question I've been asked a lot. Okay. First, I wanted to just, for everybody else's benefit, to make sure everybody understands the difference between a spirit and a ghost. A ghost is not a spirit person. A ghost has no intelligence behind it and you can't communicate with it. It's either an apparition left by residual energies or a sensitive person is psychometrizing usually the location. Most hauntings are of a location, some are of people. I would rather not associate the word hauntings with spirit people. I'd rather leave the word hauntings in with ghosts, so that we don't get a bit confused later. So an apparition or a psychometrizing of a location, we can be aware of past events or people that's usually gone through a traumatic event at that location. You can't communicate with them. There is no spirit. There's no suffering. There's no intelligence. That's a ghost. Now, sometimes spirit people have a desperate need to get a message through to people here. I've come across a case of this some years ago. We went to help a young girl. She was about 14 or 15, and she was having what the family believe was a haunting in her bedroom. Things were moving, there was banging around, there was noises, and she was clearly quite frightened by it. We went along, discovered it wasn't a haunting in the sense of a ghost. It was actually her deceased father. She'd never known a father. When her mother became pregnant, the father cleared off and left them, so she'd never met a father. After her father's passing, which neither her or her mother knew about, he had great difficulties over his guilt at leaving them. So he wanted to get a message through to her, a very simple message actually, to say he was sorry. And once we'd passed on the message, so clearly we needed a communicating medium, once we'd passed on the message saying he was sorry and explained to him that he was upsetting his daughter, they had no more problems. Monique, are people who commit suicide also expected? Yes, definitely. I've got some personal experience of talking to them. And are they received in the same way as people dying when it's their own time? They are, actually, because the suicides I've spoken to, in every single case I've come across, it was an act through a mental illness, some form of mental illness. People who take their own lives, it's an act of desperation. They can see no other way out of whatever difficulty they're in. And so we can regard it as a form of mental illness. When somebody passes from this world to the next world with some kind of mental, or having had a mental illness, they are cared for and looked after. They're brought to an understanding as well, or they will gain an understanding, that taking their own life has solved usually nothing upon earth. The people they've left behind, they've hurt even more. And I'll just share with you a case of this. Young woman in Italy, her and her fiancé, due to get married in a couple of months, I'm trying to remember how old they both were, probably 19, 20-ish, maybe early 20s, I can't remember, it's a few years ago. Due to get married, they were stood on a railway platform waiting for the train, and he jumped in front of the train. She was, as you could imagine, totally devastated. But what the big problem was, one of the most corrosive of emotions set in, which is guilt. She couldn't understand what she'd done wrong and felt guilty. I saw her about 3 months after this event, and she was slowly starving herself to death through neglect. We did a trans-healing sitting, and during it, her fiancé came forward and wanted to say a number of things to her, and I allowed that to take place. The first thing was, he hadn't planned to do what he did. He said it was a moment of temporary madness, that he doesn't even know why he did it. He just did it. And he wanted her to clearly understand it wasn't her fault. That was his main message. It wasn't her fault. Now, that was the healing sitting, and that was, I'm trying to remember when, though. It was when I was in Italy, maybe 15 years, 14 years ago. I still see that lady's aunt once or twice a year at Stansted on Italian week. So I know the outcome, the long-term outcome of this case. That lady is now married with children, very happily married. So we managed to help her let go of the guilt. And her fiancé was able to say how sorry he was for the pain that he'd caused. That would have been part of his healing as well, before he could progress. So certainly, yes, people who commit suicide do so through an act of desperation, which means they're not in their right mind. Jenny, do animals progress the same path at death as humans? It depends. I believe we can put all animals into two categories. Those in nature and those who've had a connection with us. I'm sure all of you would agree that a cat, a dog, a pet can and does show love for us. I've had dogs in my life. In fact, professionally, I was a dog handler in the Air Force. So I trained dogs for over 6 years. And I had a dog from puppy right through to being about 15. And I've had a lot of evidence of the survival of my dog in the spirit world. I believe that when a love bond is created, nothing, not even death, can sever that, regardless of whether it's a love between two humans or a human and an animal. What I believe happens when there's a connection between a pet and a human, it transforms the soul of that pet and it individualizes it. So they will survive in the same way that we do. And I've had quite a number of communications through different spirit people that my dog is well and happy and waiting for me. Natalia, suicide, we've answered that one already. Babs, I had the same experience with the white lion. When you've had it, I tell you, you'll never forget it. It's real. Angela, doesn't AJ, whoops. AJ's book on the Summerland say this too? Hope so, but I'm not quite sure which you're referring to now. But I hope so, because I like Andrew Jackson Davis. I am an adherent of his philosophy and his teachings. William. Will the mind and the soul be guided by the divine energy to attain perfection despite our physical life? Oh, yes, ultimately. The seven principles tell us this. Definitely. However, the physical life we have will have a direct effect upon it as to how easy or difficult it is and how quickly or slowly we progress. Matthias. Would you agree that dying is a spiritual process and not a physical? I'd actually say it's both. It has to be a physical one first, because it's our letting go of the physical and the spiritual takes over. So I believe it's half and half. At some point we switch over completely from one completely to the other. Say that someone dies of a heart attack. Can it be that heart attack is just a consequence of the soul instead? Okay, I understand where you're going with this now. I don't know that it's like saying chicken and egg, isn't it? Which comes first, the chicken or the egg here? The heart attack is just a consequence of the I don't think so. No, as I think about this now, and hopefully getting a little bit of inspiration to help me answer this one, I do not believe so. Because if it's just the soul's time to leave the body, then we're going to have a natural transition, whereas a heart attack is caused by an illness. There's going to be a natural and more peaceful transition than the sudden shock of a heart attack and effectively, to some extent, being ejected from our bodies. So no, I don't believe so, actually. Angela, comment about forming into the same social or cultural groups they were in previously under the many rooms in my mansion concept. Oh, you're referring back to AJ Davis. Okay, thank you. Jenny, all right. It appears there's no more questions. And we're actually 4 minutes into overtime. Ziggy, I spoke too soon. What about the different levels of spiritual realms? Yeah. When does the true self-realization occur? And in which dimension beyond Nirvana? I don't know about Nirvana. I'm really not sure about that. It doesn't feature in our teachings. However, maybe you can let us know sometime exactly where that is. However, I don't actually necessarily think there is a particular set time or place. It's individual for each person. as to what they have to go through to come to an understanding about their life. But we do know for every single soul, eternal progress is open to them. And I have to say, regardless of how bad someone's been. So this does take in your Adolf Hitlers, your Saddam Husseins, your whoever they are, the Attila the Huns. Remember, eternity is an awful long time. So we have a lot of time in which to come to these realizations as to exactly when and where. It doesn't really matter. It's the fact that we can do. But all of our teachings, two things, ultimately giving us the same answer. Have no fear of death. Do that through educating yourself on the subject, which we're doing this evening, but also, most importantly, how you live this life. This life's important. Be kind to people. Thank you for joining me. And I think it's time now to say good night. Thank you.